Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, a school in Columbus has a unique workforce development program that helps students offset the cost of tuition. Jay Fox will have more on that, as well as info on credit card rewards and e-cigarette use in youth. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Cristo Rey Columbus High School is a private Roman Catholic high school founded in 2013, and they have an enrollment of more than 400 students. They blend workforce development, education, and community impact. Their professional work-study program places students from low- to moderate-income families into professional work roles across the city of Columbus while helping fund their college prep high school education. This year, more than 100 businesses are part of the effort, and Kristen Mutchler joins us now on Columbus Perspective to tell us more. Welcome.
Thank you, Jay.
What is the professional work-study program at the high school, and how did it begin?
Well, the professional work-study program is what truly sets our high school apart. And our groundbreaking professional work study program is the cornerstone of our school motto. We provide a high quality education to students from low to moderate income families, as you just mentioned. And the professional work study program enables our students to work 5 days a month in professional roles at one of our business partners while attending school. These jobs that our students work cover 35% of the cost of their education, and it gives our students real world experience, resume building opportunities, and career exposure. Most teenagers don't get that, at least until college.
Now, are the students working during the school day, or is it after school and on the weekends?
That's a great question. They work while they're going to school and while they're taking a rigorous course load. The way it works is that a team of students fills one full-time work-study position, and each member of that student team will work one full day each week, approximately about 8:30 to 3:30, and an extra day every 4 weeks of the school year. The times might vary depending on the needs of the business and the proximity of that business to our high school, but this is also a graded class and it's part of our curriculum. So our students get evaluated each day and each semester. It's a graduation requirement for all of them.
What types of industries are available to these students? Is it typically blue collar, or does the scope expand beyond technical trade?
It does. It's actually pretty different from technical trade. So we partner with 100 business partners, but they're across high demand industries like healthcare, engineering, law, finance, tech, and nonprofit. But what all those jobs share is that they're professional office jobs, typically. The most student requested industries this year are healthcare, STEAM, automotive, animal welfare and adoption, and architecture.
Well, that's certainly gonna help the nursing shortage that we have here in Central Ohio.
Oh my gosh, yes. So many of our students are super interested in that. What? So yeah, they engage in like entry level activities from customer service and social media strategy, IT support, that kind of stuff.
What happens after high school? Do they go straight to work? Do they go on to college? Is there a partnership with Columbus State? What happens?
Most of our students go on to college. So every year, going all the way back to our first graduating class of 2017, our classes have proudly achieved a 100% college acceptance. So about 92%, though, of the class of 2025 committed to a college. So most go on to college.
When the students come to the high school, having heard all of the news reports about the economy, the effects of tariffs, the lack of available jobs, and the rising cost of living, what is their attitude like entering a program like this? Do they think it'll make a difference, or is it just, we got to put the time in?
They definitely think it's going to make a difference. The number one reason that students attend Cristo Rey is for the professional work study program. You know, it's really hard to say what the job market is going to be like for anyone, but we feel like our students are going to be uniquely prepared to meet the demands of the future. Our hope is that our students will be back in Columbus after college as their eyes are open to everything our city has to offer through the professional work study program. And it would be awesome if they come back to become our future supervisors. I mean, that's the hope. So, yeah, it's really hard hard to say, but our students believe in the program and are super motivated to participate.
Did you find the businesses or did the businesses find you?
We go out and find the businesses, and we are now old enough that sometimes our businesses are finding us. So we want to get the word out there that we're looking for work-study partners.
Is this a model that will expand beyond the Columbus boundaries?
Yes, we actually are part of a network of schools. We're part of the Cristo Rey Network, and there are 40 schools like us across the United States, starting at Seattle and through Florida and, you know, through New York, all across the country.
What do you tell your students to expect the job market to be like in 5 years?
It's really hard to say what that's going to be like, but we feel like we are preparing them for those demands through their jobs. Hopefully they get a wide range of exposure and they have a wide skill set that they're ready to meet those demands, whatever they may be.
Now, if folks listening want to learn more about the high school, what's the website?
www.crchsworks.org.
All right. We want to thank Kristen Mutchler for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
It is estimated that roughly 20% of Central Ohio's youth have reported vaping electronic cigarettes. That number includes both 1 in 4 high school students and 1 in 10 middle school students. That figure is double the national average. In Columbus specifically, the numbers are even higher. Brian King is the Executive Vice President for U.S. Programs for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. And Kate King, no relation, is the past president of the National Association of School Nurses. And they are both with us on Columbus Perspective this morning to discuss this issue. Good morning, Kate. Let's start with you. Good morning. What are e-cigarettes and why are they so dangerous?
Well, e-cigarettes are the new way of delivering tobacco and nicotine, really, to our youth in schools, you know, as you said, middle and high school. So the danger is the amount of nicotine that these devices delivered to children, as much as 20 packs of cigarettes or more per one device. And so while we don't want children smoking tobacco, these have upped the game. We see changes in behavior when children are addicted to e-cigarettes. We see impulse control changing, sleep patterns, eating patterns, interest in school. And we don't really know the long-term effects of vaping because it hasn't been around long enough. However, we do see these early short-term health effects. We also know that they expose kids to formaldehyde, lead, benzene. You know, a lot of kids think that these are safe because you're not using smoke. And yet we see that they're putting chemicals into their lungs. Very concerning.
And that could affect early onset asthma and a variety of other pulmonary diseases, correct?
It could. And we are also looking at how does that change their brain patterns with so much nicotine. As school nurses, we get referrals. We see kids who are jittery, jumpy, high blood pressure, high heart rate. We also get referrals, honestly, for kids using the bathroom too much because they're sneaking out of class to use the bathroom to access their e-cigarettes.
Now, tobacco is not the only thing that goes into these electronic cigarettes, correct?
Correct.
So to what degree does vaping marijuana exacerbate the effects of marijuana when used electronically rather than the traditional way of smoking, I guess?
Well, just like nicotine, using vaping with marijuana increases, there's an increased amount. And often I have seen in my school nurse career, and I practice in Columbus, Ohio, interestingly enough, we have, again, seen overdoses with serious health effects in schools. We'll have to call the emergency medical services for that.
Do you see this potentially as a gateway to other drug paraphernalia?
I don't know that we have the data on that, but we do know that children, especially adolescents' brain, is very susceptible to addiction. Therefore, if using e-cigarettes or using vaping with marijuana, that addiction factor increases multiple times, and therefore we can extrapolate that, yes, this form of addiction could lead to other things.
Final question for you, Kate, and this is a biggie. How do we gently instruct kids about the risks that they face without further inflaming desire for the products because of youthful rebellion?
Well, gently isn't the word I would use. However, I think it's direct and supportive. First of all, we need to make sure that parents and teachers in schools know and understand what this is and be looking for that. But then parents and schools need to look at this as a supportive mechanism, but being just very direct and honest with students about the effects of addiction and health sequelae from these products. It is just like we've talked to parents before, have that conversation before you think your child is using e-cigarettes. Have those conversations, look in their rooms, look in their purses, make sure that you can see that. And if you find that, again, it is this supportive thing, you're addicted to something, let's get you help rather than punitive.
You know, I'm going to show my age and sound like somebody's grandfather now, but in my day, we called it scared straight. And the one specific commercial I will never forget is, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. And it has stuck with me for decades. Brian, let's turn to you. If you have to be 18 to buy cigarettes and 21 to smoke recreational marijuana here in Ohio, why is vaping not regulated the same way?
Well, e-cigarettes are regulated as tobacco products in the United States. And as a result, you have to be 21 to purchase tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. And so regardless of whatever state you're in, there is now a federal law that prohibits it. That said, the FDA has authorized some e-cigarettes for sale, but that doesn't make them safe or legal for underage persons to use.
So here's my question, and I probably already know the answer. Much like an underaged individual buying beer or alcohol or cigarettes, retailers are just selling it to underage minors, correct?
Well, we do know that there are activities across the supply chain. And so we do know that youth are purchasing these products illegally in some areas. They're also obtaining them through social sources. Actually, that's the most common route that we see kids obtaining these through friends and family. But regardless of the source, it's important that we do have effective regulation at the federal level. And so the FDA has this responsibility, in addition to other federal agencies like Customs and Border Protection, to make sure that we're preventing these products from entering the supply chain, but also monitoring those within the supply chain, including retailers and distributors. And they do that by routine inspections to make sure that they're preventing as many products as possible from getting into the hands of our nation's kids.
Is there any punitive action being taken against the retailers if they're caught selling to people under 21?
Yes, there are. And so the FDA works in coordination with all 50 states as well as territories to conduct investigations, inspections on a routine basis of retailers. And they frequently issue warning letters to retailers that have either sold to underage persons or have sold illegal products that don't have FDA authorization. And if there's continued violations, the retailers can be subject to civil money penalties where they're fined. And if they continue to do so further, there also could be a no tobacco sale order that could prevent the retailer from selling tobacco products altogether.
Are legislators more focused on the hardware, the actual devices themselves, or the contents of the vaping juice, as they call it?
Well, it's a combination of both. When it comes to kids, both of them are concerning. We know the products themselves are designed in ways to appeal to kids, including some that resemble gaming devices and smartphones, even some that resemble everyday objects like highlighters. But it's also those ingredients as well that you heard earlier from Kate, the concerns. And the most notable is nicotine, because it's so highly addictive. And once you start using them even infrequently, it could lead to longer-term dependence and addiction.
You talked about this being a federal issue and the need for federal mandates, and you explained what's going on with the FDA. What's happening at the state and local level in regard to these issues?
Well, there are activities at the state level, but unfortunately, we are seeing reductions in that support at the federal level, which is trickling down. There's been recent proposals to eliminate CDC's Office on Smoking and Health, which is the primary conduit to support states to do tobacco control work, including addressing e-cigarettes. And so it's critical that we have this comprehensive approach with, you know, federal government, but also state and local activities. And so there's continued work to support this. There's also local and state level policies that are being implemented to help prevent youth access and also to educate people about that. But we're at a perilous time where we're seeing reductions in these evidence-based strategies that we know work regardless of whether they're being implemented at the national, state, or local level.
A quarter of a century ago, the Tobacco Settlement Act afforded a lot of public service education about the dangers of smoking for young people. Has that money effectively dried up now?
Well, those payments from the Master Settlement Agreement in 1998 are in perpetuity. And so states are continuing to get that money. But the problem is states are not allocating it for tobacco control. And many aren't even allocating it for public health. And so you have a situation where, you know, other costs and bills are being paid with these resources. But we know through evidence-based data over many years that if we were to allocate those dollars to the strategies we know work, including health education campaigns at the population level, that would help prevent youth from using these products and help adults who smoke to quit.
For listeners that want to learn more about this subject specifically, what is the best website that we can direct them to?
Yeah, so if you're interested in broader issues related to tobacco, you can go to our website, tobaccofreekids.org. And if you're interested in resources to help support kids around tobacco use, including resources around the health risks, you can go to teen.smokefree.gov.
We want to thank Brian King and Kate King for being our guests this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Here in Central Ohio, it is estimated that more than 1 million people use a credit card that gives them rewards. In today's dynamic financial landscape, working class families are strategically turning to credit card rewards to manage their shopping expenses. Richard Hunt is the executive chairman of the Electronic Payments Coalition, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Great to be with you.
And good to be with you, sir. Typically, Richard, how much does a consumer need to spend on their credit card to get any kind of reward?
$1.
Really?
Jay, it's a great, yeah, look, Jay, it's a great benefit to use a credit card for safety and security, for ease and convenience. And as soon as you get a credit card, you can start accumulating both cash back and reward miles, both. So I encourage all your listeners to use your credit card as soon as you can, sign up for all those reward programs, and of course, pay off your bill just as soon as you can. We in America have this pattern of paying off your credit card at the end of the month once your statement is due, and I understand that for cash flow purposes, but you can also pay it off on a daily basis through a website or through your phone. So while I usually pay my credit card bill off at the end of the month, I know many people who pay it off sometimes daily.
Now, what is the advantage to paying it off daily? Because to me, that's more like the American Express example, whereas you charge it, you got to pay the balance when it comes due, rather than the revolving credit story of most of these cards.
Yeah, look, some people just pay it daily strictly for budgetary reasons. There's no incentive to pay it off on a daily basis. You're going to get reward miles whether you pay it off on a daily basis or at the end of the month, and cash back as well.
Now, you said reward miles, and my next question is, how are cardholders rewarded? Is it just airline miles? Is it cash? Is there merchandise? How does that work?
Every credit card is different. That's the beauty of the credit card system. Some people may want to tie it to a hotel. Some people may want to tie it to rental cars. And yes, some people may want to tie it strictly to an airline. I'll give you a couple of stats here, Jay. 15 million people just last year used reward miles that they had accumulated to travel on an airline, including some 200,000 who flew in and out of Ohio itself. Think about this. When you use your miles to travel via airline, when you land, you either may get an Uber, you may get a rental car, you may get a hotel, you may go eat out, or you may go to Ohio State or Cincinnati football game as well. Think about the economic stimulus that has in each and every community throughout the country. So 15 million people accumulated reward miles just to fly around the country. And most people think about rewards and they think of miles for airlines. But the number one reward people use is cash back. Some people don't care about traveling. They just want to make ends meet each and every month, usually around back to school or around the Christmas holidays in December. You can also use your reward miles or cash back to pay down your bill at the end of the month. So it's not just for traveling. It's also to pay down your credit card expenditures.
Let me ask you this. I'm operating on a revolving card, and I have interest payments. I'm not making the payments. I'm not paying off the balance in full every month. What is the trade-off between the interest on a high balance and the value of the rewards themselves?
What we do is we tell people, especially those making less than $60,000, this is a way for access to credit. Not everybody in this country can make ends meet. Some people have a hard time making ends meet each and every month, and this is their way to credit. Having a credit card is much less costly to your viewers than going to a payday lender where they charge 125%. So that's why we encourage people to pay off their credit card just as soon as they can, whether that's on a daily basis or a monthly basis. We don't like people having debt. That's why when you use your credit card and you accumulate those reward miles, you can use those reward miles to pay down your credit card debt.
Is there an independent site that compares the programs of cards, kind of like Experian does for travel?
Sure. You can go to thepointsguy.com. You can also go to Consumer Reports as well. The Points Guy actually does a very good job of comparing credit cards. What is the best credit card for each household? It depends on your individual need. Some people want to pay a higher credit card fee to get more perks. Some people don't want to pay any fee and you have less perks. There are some 6,000 credit cards that are available to your viewers. You can pick and choose how it best suits your individual need.
What is the number one rated rewards program today?
Look, that's across the board. You can say it's American Express. You can say it's Capital One. You can say it's J.P. Morgan Chase. There's no true number one. It all depends what fits your need. Do you want to travel? Do you want to use it for cash back? Like I said earlier, some people could care less about miles. They just want the cash back.
How old do you have to be now to get a credit card?
You can start receiving a credit card with your parents' signature as early as 16 or 18 without the parents' signature. It's another way to build credit. Again, make sure you pay off your credit card bill as soon as you can. But look, we all know, in addition to the Social Security number, the one number you need to know is your credit rating score. Obviously, the higher, the better. You want to build credit just as soon as you can. But, Jay, you got to be responsible right out of the gate.
And that means making sure that you pay not only off, but also on time, and you live within your means, right?
that the last point you just made, living within your means is the most critical. Don't make purchases you cannot afford to make. We've all been taught that from day one. Only spend what you can afford and nothing more than that. Unfortunately, some people can't do that. So just be very responsible with your credit card.
All right. We want to thank Richard Hunt for being with us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Congressional redistricting. It's a process that may sound complicated or even boring, but it's critical in possibly determining who represents you in the U.S. House of Representatives. Redrawing political maps can shift the balance of power in a particular congressional district from one party to another, or strengthen or weaken a party's voter numbers in that district. Right now, Ohio lawmakers are getting ready to redraw the state's maps. The General Assembly's first deadline to adopt a plan is the end of this month. Redistricting is supposed to be done every 10 years after the U.S. Census, but Ohio hit a political roadblock, so has to do it again now. Here's what happened. A supermajority did not agree to the maps adopted in 2022, so they're only good for 4 years. The new map will have to be passed with a 3/5 vote in both the Ohio House and Senate, and by at least half of the minority Democrats. If it doesn't pass, the Ohio Redistricting Commission has to adopt a plan by the end of October with Democratic support. If it seems like the state just did this, you're right. When Ohio last went through the redrawing process, maps were being drawn for the state legislative level and the congressional level. This time, it will only be the state's 15 congressional districts being redrawn. The legislature is now accepting map submissions from the public through an online portal. At this time, Republicans hold 10 of the 15 seats to the Democrats' 5. Political experts say Republicans are looking to pick up a couple more seats through redistricting. Now, don't confuse what's happening in Ohio with what you've probably been hearing about from Texas and California, where bitter battles and back and forth over redistricting for the midterm elections have been going on. Ohio's situation is somewhat different. Joining me now to explain all of this is Bowling Green State University political science professor, Dr. Nicole Califf-Hughes. You may recall she joined me as an analyst on election night for the presidential election last November. Good morning, Dr. Califf-Hughes. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here. So first of all, why is Ohio's situation different than Texas and California?
So we're in a little bit of a different position based on our state constitution here and based on a constitutional amendment that was passed in 2018 that was designed to guarantee that we have a little more bipartisanship in the process. This is a new thing for Ohio. It was the first time we did this was after that 2020 census when we were having to redistrict. And so we were going to have to do this regardless of what happened in other states, regardless of what the current administration called for in Texas, regardless of California's response. We were going to be here no matter who won the election based on our own state constitution.
Now, those are being redistricted because of the upcoming midterm elections. But if the maps here are approved, they'll still have an impact on 2026 in the midterm here, correct?
They will. And so our congressional maps in Ohio were drawn with this process that was supposed to encourage a little bit more bipartisan support. And so we did the census in 2020. The U.S. Constitution mandates we do that every 10 years. And then we draw the lines based on how many people are in every state. And every state has a different process. And in Ohio, for congressional seats, the General Assembly gets a crack at it. And if they can't get that supermajority where you have both 60% of people in both chambers voting yes, including 50% of the two major parties, so that's both Democrats and Republicans, then it goes to our redistricting commission, which you may be familiar with from our state legislative districts. If they can't get it done with enough bipartisan support, then it goes back to the General Assembly. And then they get another crack at it, and then they can essentially keep trying until it passes with a simple majority. If you only pass it with a simple majority, which in Ohio you can do without Democratic support, and that's what happened, then those districts are only good for 2 election cycles or 4 years. And so we are back here having to redraw our maps because we couldn't get maps that had both Democrat and Republican support.
So with that being said, and seeing how the legislature is set up right now, and then the balance of the redistricting commission, how likely do you think it is that this will end up in court again, as we saw in the past?
Well, very likely. If you recall, our congressional districts were declared unconstitutional by the Ohio Supreme Court twice in 2021 and 2022 with the first effort at our districts. We went with the unconstitutional maps, essentially because we had to. We ran out of time. And my guess is that's going to happen again. It is very difficult to get maps that both the Republican majority in the General Assembly and the Democratic minority in the General Assembly can agree to, particularly because we do have pressure from Ohio senators and from the federal government to increase the number of Republican seats in Ohio. What makes that even a little bit more interesting is the fact that Ohio is a Republican majority state, but it's slight, right? You have President Trump got about 55% of the vote. Senator Bernie Moreno got about 51% of the vote. I think I'm rounding up a little bit there, but about that, it wasn't like an 80 or 90% victory. The seats that Republicans have called for would give Republicans 80% of Ohio congressional seats. And so that would be a lot more of a Republican congressional delegation than we actually have people who tend to vote Republican in Ohio.
You mentioned the two state Supreme Court challenges or rejections of the congressional maps. We saw the Supreme Court reject the legislative maps five times before they actually did come to an agreement with the redistricting commission on the legislative maps last time. But do you think that because the state Supreme Court, you know, rejected several proposed maps last time because they were said to be unfairly gerrymandered to benefit Republicans, that Republicans will try to draw maps that are more equitable this time? Or, like you said, is it still going to be that effort to pick up a couple seats?
No, I don't think they're going to. And they've pretty much said as much. And a couple things in the court have changed since a couple years ago as well. So in 2022, Republican state legislators in Ohio passed a bill that attached partisan labels to the court seats. So when you're voting for state Supreme Court now, you will actually see partisan labels. Prior to 2022, these were nonpartisan offices. And so because they were nonpartisan offices, we actually had a little bit more representation across the political spectrum on the Ohio Supreme Court. Now, because you have partisan labels attached to these seats, people tend to vote pretty strongly along party lines. And so you have a much more Republican state Supreme Court than we did previously, both in terms of partisanship, but also in terms of allegiance to the party, because now you're relying on a lot of party funds and party marketing to run for those seats. And so we have a much more Republican state Supreme Court. And so my guess is they're not going to find these districts as quickly as unconstitutional as they did previously, but we don't know because we're in totally new territory here.
Now, the state Supreme Court now 6-1 with a Republican majority. Now, you touched on it talking about, you know, if the Republicans pick up seats and the percentages. So, you know, why again is all of this so important? Why does it matter to voters?
Well, this should matter to voters regardless of what your partisanship is, because we tend to think about members of Congress, political scientists often refer to members of Congress as single-minded seekers of re-election. They run for re-election every 2 years. We know there was a really strong incumbency advantage there, so we tend to re-elect the same people. And that's because we form relationships with those people. They deliver goods and services for us, both in terms of stuff for our districts, but also help with the federal government. So like your veterans benefits, your Social Security benefits, Medicare, like if you are having issues with those services from the federal government, your member of Congress is your advocate there. And so if we start shifting these districts quite a bit, you don't form those relationships as a voter. And the proposed districts, roughly proposed, they haven't been officially proposed, but what we've kind of heard is that we're going to actually be chopping up some districts. And so people are going to lose their representatives, becoming a pretty small minority in their districts, and they're going to have a harder time getting representation.
So does redrawing the lines, though, guarantee victories for the majority party in that district?
It does not. We often tend to talk about it like it does, but we can't forget that the candidates actually matter. And we have a really good example of that in Ohio. Ohio's 9th district, which is up at the top of the state, it's Marcy Kaptur's district. Marcy Kaptur is the longest serving female member of Congress. She was elected for the first time in 1982 and has served since. Her district was redrawn after 2020 to be a primarily Republican district. It was designed to be a Republican pickup. They saw it as something easy to win. She has actually won both of her last two elections because she is still, even though it's a Republican majority district, she is still very popular and has a long record of service. It doesn't guarantee that she's going to stay there, but you have to think it's not just, is it a Republican or is it a Democrat or is it an independent? people have connections with their members, and delivering to the district really, really is what matters. And so you need to run quality candidates. You need to run people who can bring back those benefits. And no amount of drawing the district lines in a strange shape or to benefit one party can overcome a candidate that can't do that.
Yeah, she's been there 43 years now at this point. So besides the 9th district, Marcy Kaptur's district, which other districts do you think could be or will be most affected by redistricting?
The other district that they've said that they're targeting or that they're likely to target and how they draw these lines is the 13th district out in Akron-Canton area. Right now, that is a predominantly Democratic district. What I have heard they're looking to do, and they've kind of said as much, is they're looking to kind of chop that up. So instead of having a Democrat majority district, the Democrats become the minority in a couple of other districts, and that will sliver that off. And they're looking to make that one of their Republican pickup seats. Or so people have said, we can't know for sure until we actually see what the drafts look like.
And if that does come to fruition, then the Republicans would have 12 seats to the Democrats, 3 representing Ohio. So in the time we have left, what should voters watch for in this process?
A couple things. I think they should watch for what the maps look like, how the maps change, whether they are like compact and contiguous, like whether it's like a strange looking shape. We tend to like districts that are fairly compact because that usually means you're picking up the same population. Make sure the districts aren't cutting up the communities so much that your like school district is in 2 or 3 congressional seats. That would be kind of strange. And to actually see who your representative is going to be. Voters don't really have a chance to weigh in on these districts in like through an election. We're just kind of, the result is the result, essentially, the legislature decides or the courts, wherever it ends up. So I think really paying attention to who your representative is, what these districts actually look like, and who your state legislators are. You always, as a voter, as a resident of Ohio, always have the opportunity to reach out to your representatives in or your senators in the General Assembly, and you can share your concerns with them. And regardless of whether you think they're doing the best job or the worst job or anywhere in between, is you have the opportunity to make your voice heard. And so you can have your preferences kind of reflected based on communicating with your own elected officials.
And we will see how this all plays out through September and possibly into October and beyond. Dr. Nicole Califf-Hughes with the Bowling Green State University, thank you so much for your perspective on this today. Appreciate the education on it as well.
Thank you for having me.
I'm John O'Hurley, and I support Paralyzed Veterans of America because our heroes have sacrificed so much for our independence.
I had just come home. I had noticed my legs were swollen. Next thing I know, it was 3 weeks later. I was paralyzed. PVA has brought me back to life.
While parachuting with my platoon, my parachute didn't open. It left me paralyzed. I just don't think my family would be as happy as they are without the support that I received from Paralyzed Veterans of America.
For more than 75 years, Paralyzed Veterans of America has kept a promise to never leave a fallen hero behind. That's why Paralyzed Veterans of America is providing specialized medical care, life-changing treatments, benefits our heroes earned, the jobs they want, and the accessible vehicles and homes they need. Our paralyzed veterans have helped us live the lives we enjoy today. It's our turn to give them the best lives possible. To learn more, go to pva.org today.
Well, if you've checked your electric bill lately, you've likely experienced some sticker shock. Ohio electric bills rose by more than $15 a month this year and are expected to keep climbing. But help could be on the way no matter where you live. 10TV's Kevin Landers looks into one lawmaker's possible solution.
On scorching summer days when Ohioans turn on the AC,
or on frigid nights when we turn up the heater,
the state's electric grid can strain under the pressure.
An Ohio lawmaker has a solution to lower your energy bills and put money in your pocket.
Having your thermostat or water heater under the control of your electric company may sound like a strange concept, but that's exactly what State Representative Roy Klopfstein is proposing.
Our electric prices are not going to go down. And the best I think we can hope for at this point is stabilization or less increases.
Klopfstein has proposed making voluntary demand response statewide. AEP already offers the program to its customers.
They give them the ability to manage peak demand. And peak demand is where we have blackouts. and where bad things happen if they can't manage that really hot day or that really cold day.
Under the plan, power companies could reduce the energy in your home through your smart thermostat during extreme heat or cold. The goal is to reduce the load on the electric grid. Representative Klopstein says using less power can save residential customers money.
We're at a point now where between inflation and demand, your bill's going up. I don't see any way it will not be and continue to go up in the near future.
The Ohio Environmental Council supports the voluntary demand response proposal.
Folks who are enrolled in a demand response program will have their thermostats adjusted by a few degrees, maybe 1 to 3 degrees. They will get a notification on their phone, and they can opt out at any time or override.
Large energy users like data centers and hospitals already use demand response programs to help reduce their energy consumption and prevent the grid from getting overloaded. If lawmakers approve this latest proposal, residential customers statewide will get to enjoy the savings.
Demand response programs are a very cost-effective way to reduce strain on our electric grid while saving folks money.
If lawmakers do approve this plan, it will ultimately need to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. Kevin Landers, 10TV News.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.